satisfy your celluloid addiction with the Cinema Junkie podcast, where you can mainline film with the people who make them, as well as those who love them, program them, and celebrate them for their cultural impact. Listen to Cinema Junkie wherever you get your podcasts.
The opinions shared by our guests in today's episode are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of Port of Entry or KPBS.
It comes at no surprise that the first year of President Trump's second term gives us a lot to reflect on and much more to digest. Much of the national conversation has centered on international issues, particularly the actions and intentions of the United States abroad.
From Venezuela and Greenland to Mexico and beyond. But what's been just as striking is what's been happening here at home.
And the headlines have been especially telling.
Following breaking news in Minneapolis, where a woman was shot and killed by an ICE agent.
ICE protesters banging on federal officers' vehicles, who deployed tear gas to disperse crowds.
Overnight, unrest and anger in Minneapolis after federal agents shot and killed another person.
Federal government and local agents are offering up some very different views of what happened.
In Minneapolis, federal immigration enforcement operations have been in the spotlight after protests and confrontations led to the fatal shootings of Renee Nicole Good and, more recently, Alex Preti, both at the hands of federal agents. Officials say investigations are still underway, and critics have raised serious questions about how these actions are being carried out.
There is no question these tactics have ignited and deeply divided public opinion, specifically along party lines, which made us wonder, how have all these policies, tactics, and enforcement trickled down here in the border region?
Our producer Julio went to the Otay Mesa U.S.-Mexico border crossing to find out what commuters are thinking.
Christian, a 20-year-old convenience store cashier, says he's been stopped four times in the past 2 years. He believes he's been targeted because of his skin complexion.
Y ya tiene, pues de hace como unos dos años para acá, que ya yo creo que unas cuatro veces me han pedido mis documentos en la calle. Yo, pues afortunadamente, pues yo tengo mi situación migratoria regulada. O sea, yo no tengo...
Christian says he has legal status, which means he doesn't fear deportation.
Jesus, a waiter at a downtown San Diego restaurant, shared that some of his acquaintances were detained at work.
Ah, sí, a un conocidos amigos que le han pasado que han tenido que dejar a sus familiares, sus niños, sus esposas, porque se los llevan detenidos y se las pasan dos, tres meses en la cárcel.
He says some were held by ICE for as long as 3 months, completely separated from their families.
The detentions disrupted their livelihoods, he says. Incidents like these have left many workers obviously feeling anxious. We're also hearing that many vulnerable workers have stopped going to work or have pulled back from everyday activities like shopping.
For example, Roberto Chavez, a produce import-export manager, says his sales have dramatically dropped since last year.
Pues se vio afectado en las ventas y todo eso. Se nos empezó a poner más lento. La gente dejó de salir a consumir. Se vio. Aquí en México se nos quedó mucho producto.
Okay. He says many of his customers in the U.S. have stopped buying produce altogether, leaving much of it to go to waste on the Mexican side of the border.
New enforcement approaches by the Department of Homeland Security through ICE and CBP have made daily life more difficult for border commuters.
Like longer wait times, says Valeria, a worker in downtown San Diego.
Se ha tardado más. Hace como que unos 3 años siento que se cruzaba más rápido a comparación de ahorita que se hacen 2-3 horas de fila caminando.
The overwhelming majority of people we interviewed echo that sentiment. Wait times in the pedestrian lanes have increased, making the commute more tense and stressful.
And those tensions aren't just limited to those crossing into the U.S. Many commuters report that Mexican authorities have also become stricter in enforcing their immigration laws, sometimes sending American residents of Mexico back to the U.S. for lacking proper visa or vehicle documentation.
One of them is Marcela Osorio, whose son was denied entry back into Mexico while driving her car, which was not registered in his name.
Para salir, no me lo dejaron salir. Que el carro tenía que estar registrado a nombre de mi hijo, y mi hijo está en la aseguranza. Y eso fue el motivo que no me lo dejaron cruzar.
A similar situation happened to Carlos, a dual U.S. and Mexican citizen who works in the moving business.
La otra vez que crucé a Tijuana, me regresaron porque yo vivo en Tijuana. Toda mi vida me crié en Tijuana. Nomás que necesitaba mi pasaporte o mi doble ciudadanía y no la tenía. Y me regresaron para San Diego.
Carlos says that he was denied entry back into Tijuana because he lacked documentation proving his Mexican citizenship.
These enforcement changes come amid broader diplomatic tensions between the U.S. and Mexico.
And commuters say the impact of these changes is being felt in their everyday lives. To help us understand how all of this has unfolded,
both nationally and here in the border region,
we're joined by two guests.
KPBS border reporter Gustavo Solís and Cassandra López, director of litigation of Al Otro Lado.
From KPBS, this is Port of Entry,
where we tell cross-border stories that connect us.
I'm Alan Lilienthal.
And I'm Natalie González.
This is a Port of Entry conversation.
Trump 2.0, the immigration and border impact. Stay tuned.
Powerful people can abuse their position, and the community expects them to be held accountable. That's where the KPBS Investigations team comes in. If you have a tip for us, send an email to investigations@kpbs.org or message on the Signal app at 619-594-8177.
You're listening to Port of Entry.
Hello, everyone. I'm Alan. With me is my co-host, Natalie. We're following up on a conversation we began in November 2024, shortly after President Trump was elected to a second term. At the time, we were examining what that election could mean for the border and migrant communities in our region. And now, a year into Trump's return to office, we're taking stock of what has actually happened.
And it has been a headline-grabbing first year on immigration, to put it mildly. And to help us recap, we're joined by Gustavo Solís, KPBS's border reporter.
Hola.
Hola, Gustavo. Thank you for being here.
Hola, Gustavo. And joining us to help explain the legal framework behind many of these changes is immigration attorney Cassandra López, director of litigation at Al Otro Lado.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Welcome, Cassandra.
Thank you for being here, Cassandra. Muchas gracias. Let's start with you, Gustavo. Mm-hmm. Much of your reporting this year has reached national audiences. And for listeners who may not be familiar with your work, can you walk us through what you have covered and what has stood out the most?
Oh, gosh. It's all kind of a blur. I've just kind of been documenting what the Trump administration has been doing in terms of realizing his mass deportation agenda. So a lot of that has been reporting on how decisions made in Washington impact people on the ground here and really providing a face to these abstract policies of detention and deportation and mass arrest and really just showing how it impacts individuals and communities. Another big thread that I've been pursuing this year is surveillance technologies and how those help the mass deportation efforts, but undermine our civil liberties.
You had a lot of stories that were top stories for KPBS, but for example, the one about federal data revealing the truth about immigration detention was a big story, a national story. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah, that's been a big thing just in the immigration reporting space. Explainers or fact-checking, really, pointing out that there's a disconnect between what people in Washington tell us and what the truth is on the ground. Even this morning, I was hearing about how they're going after national security threats, the worst of the worst, murders and rapists. And the story I did was just looking at ICE's own data on who they are detaining and what their criminal background is. And it overwhelmingly shows that the majority of people in detention do not have a violent criminal record or any criminal record. They're mostly for immigration violations, which are civil violations.
Another big story that you covered, Gustavo, was about lawyers using habeas corpus in efforts to free immigrants from detention. Can you tell us about that story, and maybe we can bring Cassandra to the conversation and she can explain to us a little bit about habeas corpus?
That was a massive story, one of my favorite ones of the year, and it wouldn't have happened without Cassandra and other immigration lawyers. It was just this nationwide movement, but not really movement, just lawyers everywhere filing these habeas petitions as almost a last-ditch effort to get people out of immigration detention. There's a paper trail in court that is semi-public, and you can see in detail how people were detained, what their background is, why they are challenging detention of it. It tells the entire story of what's been happening around the country. I mean, some of these cases are, I remember day laborers in Los Angeles that got caught up in those raids being sent to Otay Mesa Detention Center. Some of the most tragic ones were people out of state where there is more cooperation between local and federal law enforcement. Places I remember in Georgia and Florida, people getting pulled over by local police for a traffic stop, and then local police calling ICE, and they end up in Otay Mesa. And I think it was also very inspiring seeing these immigration lawyers, these attorneys, make a good faith effort to fight and push back against that by filing these petitions in federal courts and really challenging the detention that was happening. So it was an example of everything wrong that was happening, but also some inspiring examples of people trying to do something about it.
Can you briefly tell us what habeas corpus is?
So habeas corpus is a provision in the Constitution that allows individuals to challenge unlawful detention that can either be detained by the federal government, detention by the state government, by immigration. And so if a person is being unlawfully detained, they can ask a judge to grant a petition for habeas corpus, which is to release the body. It's a law that allows anyone, whether they're a citizen or a non-citizen, to challenge unlawful detention within the United States.
And is that still being upheld even amidst the climate we're in?
Well, in the context of immigration, so maybe to back up, immigration detention has been a feature of immigration law now for many years, for decades, but the Trump administration has dramatically increased the use of immigration detention. Starting last year in the summer, they began taking the position that anyone who entered the country without permission, who entered without inspection, would be subject to mandatory custody. And this was a reversal of really decades of interpretation of the Immigration and Nationality Act and a total about-face where even if a person can show that they're not a flight risk and that they're not a danger to the community, the Trump administration is saying, if you cross the border without inspection, you must stay in immigration detention until your immigration case is resolved, until either you're granted relief or you're deported. And so the one avenue, because immigration judges now, when there are individuals who appear before them who before last summer would otherwise have most likely been granted bond, appear before them seeking bond, the judges are saying, I don't have jurisdiction, pursuant to a BIA case called Yajure Hurtado. And now the remedy or the ability for those individuals to seek release is to go into federal court and file a petition for habeas corpus. And largely across the country, federal courts have been granting those petitions in almost every possible scenario, whether it's a person who entered without inspection. We've seen cases where people have been paroled in to seek asylum and then they're detained by ICE, and judges have been ordering that ICE released that those individuals under the same conditions of parole that they had been previously granted. Similarly, people that have been granted bond are swept up in some of these immigration enforcement operations and placed into custody, and federal court judges have been ordering release under the same terms that were previously imposed when bond was set. Our experience, especially here in San Diego, is that largely the courts have been granting these petitions and finding that the detention, in fact, is unlawful.
But habeas corpus is being upheld.
Habeas corpus petitions have been granted, which means that the district court judges are finding that the individuals in the respective cases that they have been detained in violation of the immigration law. Often we're making a variety of arguments. You might be arguing that it violates due process or the federal government's own requirement that they follow their own internal policies. But essentially, the judges are finding that people are being detained in violation of the law and granting those petitions, yes.
And is there any kind of legal framework for holding those people accountable or any kind of consequences for all these unlawful detentions?
I don't know that there is a mechanism to hold the government accountable. So I'm unaware of anyone filing, say, a lawsuit for like a tort claim, like, say, you know.
Oh, that'd be interesting. Like, yeah, you detained me for months. You kept me out of work. You have all these damages.
Yes, and yeah. I should be reimbursed. I would suspect that courts are going to be reluctant to, you know, hold ICE accountable in that regard. However, they have been granting attorney's fees and appointing attorneys to represent individuals. So, like, I have two cases where the government has agreed to settle and compensate Al Otro Lado for the work that we've done. Mm-hmm. In other cases, the Federal Defenders of San Diego here has been appointed by the court to represent individuals. So they are granting some compensation in the form of legal representation. But I'm not aware of anyone filing a lawsuit, although that's something interesting to consider whether there is any grounds there. I would doubt that there's going to be an easy remedy for people that have been wrongfully detained to obtain, say, compensation from ICE for their unlawful detention. Mm.
But even if it's not compensation, I really want to dig into this because it seems like if all these judges are finding unlawful use of power by all these agents and they're detaining all these people outside the law, essentially, who is giving them permission to do that? And why are they not if the judges themselves are finding that it's unlawful, like, where's the accountability?
There are some efforts, right? Like the class action, maybe. Would be a way, but that's a frustrating thing that folks I've interviewed tell me that, yes, they are happy that as a result of a habeas petition, they got out, they can live at home, go back to work, fight their deportation from the comfort of their home. It doesn't erase the damage that was done by that detention, yeah. And that sense of injustice is still there. They're still angry and bitter that it happened. But as far as like a way to stop it from happening, I don't know.
So, and I think that's what the habeas law guarantees or provides is, right, if you're being wrongfully detained, here's the remedy under the law that you can use to seek release. It doesn't specifically articulate any type of, say, damages that should be granted or anything beyond release of the individual. And right now, the authority to detain is coming from both a memo that ICE issued back in July, and then it's a BIA case. So the ICE and other entities, CBP or other entities that are detaining individuals under this interpretation, they're saying the Board of Immigration Appeals decided this case, Yohure Hurtado, that anybody that entered without inspection should be detained. So that's what I'm doing. I'm just following the BIA. And then the federal court is looking at that case and saying, oh, no, this violates due process. This violates the actual language of the Immigration and Nationality Act that violates other laws or potential, you know, regulations. So
what is BIA? I'm sorry.
The Board of Immigration Appeals. That's the appellate body that if you lose your case or if the government loses its case before the immigration court, it appeals to the Board of Immigration Appeals. And then from the board, if you want to appeal, you would go up to the Circuit Court of Appeals here in California. That would be the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Let's zoom out a little bit and like talk about the immigration policies that changed during 2025 and how can we compare them to other administrations. For starters, the first day that Trump took office, the CBP One app shut down and it affected the border, Tijuana and San Diego, specifically Tijuana and all of the migrant shelters. You covered a lot about that, Gustavo. Maybe we can start talking about that, the CBP One app shutting down.
Yeah, I think that was interesting to me because it showed the relationship between the Biden administration and the Trump administration, where the Biden administration created CBP-1 and really restricted asylum outside of CBP-1, right? They kind of were trying to funnel it into, you know, if you want asylum, get CBP-1. If not, you're going to have a harder time accessing it. Once that is done, the only thing Trump has to do is get rid of CBP-1. Biden already got rid of the other avenues, right, or made it harder for people to pursue those avenues. So you can see how the decisions one administration made, the Biden administration, made it a little bit easier for Trump to restrict it. I think that also highlights a critique I've heard for decades now over the immigration system is that there hasn't been immigration reform. And without legal changes, we're left with a system where one president has executive orders and different rules and different policies, and somebody else can come in and replace them. So the system is kind of set up to be vulnerable in this way, that it's vulnerable to the whims of one administration to the other. And I think the CBP one situation showed that. These changes happened in Washington, and meanwhile, thousands of folks who were, quote unquote, doing it the right way, waiting for the appointment, had their day to come in, all of a sudden were told, oh, nope, sorry, too late, you can't do it anymore. And it's incredibly unfair for the people who were waiting, but they don't really have any other course. I think for a couple of ways that policy change just underscores the chaotic nature of the immigration system.
I would agree and would also point out, unless you apply through CBP-1, you cannot apply for asylum. So if an individual comes to the port of entry and says, I fear persecution in my home country, and they don't go through CBP-1, then they're not eligible to apply for asylum. Mm-hmm. They might be eligible to apply for other forms of immigration relief that are harder to get and are less generous. Asylum ultimately provides a pathway to citizenship. Withholding of removal or protection under the Convention Against Torture do not. And I think it's all part of this, what I would say, effort to make it harder to apply for forms of relief, to make it harder to get into court, to have an immigration judge hear your case, to decide your case freely or objectively, to have an objective fact finder. There have been other changes to the asylum system that have made it essentially more difficult to apply for asylum and easier for immigration judges to dismiss cases without hearing the facts. So even if a person is able to get in to apply for asylum, the government has done things like they have the asylum cooperative agreements where the government's asking IJs to deny asylum cases because they believe that they can deport an individual to a third country. So Honduras or Guatemala under the asylum cooperative agreement. So that basically means, like, if I fear persecution and I'm asking for asylum, the government is saying that shouldn't be granted because we're going to be able to deport this person to Honduras or Guatemala, even if that person has never been there, even if that person has no ties to that community, etc. And then the other thing that I think that I would note with the asylum system is that immigration judges have been granting pre-termission more frequently. We've been hearing about these cases where basically in an effort, a purported effort to move cases along in light of this growing backlog of immigration cases, IJs are dismissing cases when they find that the applications are incomplete. So if the immigration judge believes that there's like a specific substantive answer that hasn't been adequately fleshed out or answered every single question on the I-589, the application form, the IJ can dismiss the case without getting to the facts of the case. So a person might have a legitimate fear of death or persecution in their home country, but if they say didn't adequately answer a question to the IJ's satisfaction, the IJ may dismiss that case. And oftentimes individuals are pro se, they don't have an immigration lawyer, they're filling out these forms on their own, or maybe they are working with, you know, a family member who speaks English that can help translate, or you know, it's no surprise that often people may not fill out the form perfectly or to the IJ's satisfaction. And in those cases, their cases are unfortunately getting dismissed. So I think overall, what I've seen is just an effort to curtail the use of asylum and make it really difficult to apply in front of an immigration judge and be heard and have a neutral arbiter decide your case.
Thank you, Cassandra, for that answer. We will be back after a short break.
San Diego County is known for being one of America's most expensive regions. Locals are feeling the squeeze and looking for solutions. KPBS's new series, Price of San Diego, delves into the rising cost of groceries, childcare, car insurance, and even our beloved California burrito. You won't want to miss this ongoing series live now at kpbs.org/priceofsandiego.
You're listening to Port of Entry.
And then there was the end of humanitarian parole, and we had an episode about a Venezuelan mother who entered the U.S. legally, but later she lost her legal status due to a policy change, which was the end of humanitarian parole. Can you explain to us, Cassandra, what humanitarian parole is?
parole and programs like temporary protected status are types of status where a person is admitted into the United States, but they do not have a pathway towards citizenship. So if you are paroled in, or if you're granted, say, temporary protected status, the government is saying, we're giving you permission to be here. You can apply for an employment authorization document and you can be here. We're not going to deport you. You can work legally while your either potentially asylum case proceeds. So people have been paroled in, say, through CBP-1 to seek asylum in the United States, or TPS is usually used in the case where there's been some kind of natural disaster, like a, you know, hurricane or a huge earthquake, or maybe there's some kind of war happening. So places like Haiti, Venezuela have had TPS, and the government last year just abruptly ended these programs and with very little notice to give people an opportunity to make plans. So some people with, say, TPS, temporary protected status, have been living in the United States for decades, working legally. They may have kids that were born here. They've established their life here. Usually, in fact, they're always law-abiding, because if they're not, the government's going to take their TPS status away. So these are people that are law-abiding members of the community. They're often very involved with their community. They're working, their kids are in school, whatnot. And then suddenly, you know, on a dime, the government ends that status and is saying, go back to your own country. And we've, at Al Otro Lado, seen these cases where somebody that was granted parole. In fact, I filed two habeas petitions last fall. One individual was paroled into the United States. Another individual had been granted. They were basically both paroled in for different reasons. But in any case, they were both detained at ICE check-ins, where they were reporting as directed to ICE and complying with their obligations to report and provide information about where they're living or where they're working or whatnot. And they were detained at those interviews, separated from young children. It was extremely destabilizing for elementary school kids. One person had a minor child that was like 2 or 3 and was really hard. They were the breadwinners of their family. So, you know, in every possible way, these families were really struggling because the government arbitrarily decided to end the programs with very little notice.
Are there any options left for these people?
In immigration cases, it's on a case-by-case basis, so people may have other forms of relief that they could be eligible for. So, you know, certainly it's important to get good immigration counsel and speak with an immigration lawyer and find out if you're married to a U.S. citizen. Can you obtain status through your U.S. citizen, say, if you're the victim of a violent crime? There could also be if you have a child that's has some sort of severe disability or health condition, you might be able to fight your deportation, arguing that it would cause extraordinary hardship on that child. So it's sort of a case-by-case analysis. Unfortunately, it's people, you hear this from the public or people that are maybe not familiar with immigration law, like, do it legally, or, you know, I did it the right way. I stood in line. I waited. You know, if you want to come in, you got to do it the right way, do it the legal way. But the reality is it's almost impossible to get a visa doing it the legal way, because we have very much limited the ways in which people can get status legally. You know, it could be that people are eligible for some other form of relief that they could apply for. But with respect to TPS, I think that there's some lawsuits pending, and I haven't really been following too closely the status of those, but arguing that, but I think that the Supreme Court allowed TPS to lapse as to Venezuela. That was last summer. So, you know, I don't know that there's any remedy as far as like arguing that it's improper to terminate TPS at this point.
This might be, I don't know if there's a clear answer to this, but if someone were doing it the legal way today in this day and age, what's the easiest way for someone to do that? You said it's almost impossible for someone to do it.
To be rich.
To be rich. Right. So if you are living in the United States and you're a lawful permanent resident or a citizen of the United States, you can apply for family members that are outside the United States. And if you have a spouse or you're an adult with an adult parent, then they are immediate relatives and could immediately, you know, could fairly quickly be eligible for visas. But anybody else, so if you're a sister or a brother of a U.S. citizen, those kind of other family relationships, the line is just really long. So you might be able to apply and get your, you know, immigrate another family member, but it may take 20 years to do so. Okay. So and then if you enter the United States without inspection, so if you cross the border without permission, you're not eligible to adjust status in the United States unless you leave the country and do it from Mexico, but then you trigger bars to reentry. That it, now we're getting really in the weeds, but it's basically if you're in the United States and you entered without inspection, you cannot become a lawful permanent resident in most cases unless you leave the United States and then trigger usually a 10-year bar to coming back legally. So it's sort of doing it legally kind of is lip service to a situation that really doesn't exist for most people or is not a viable option for most people because either they don't have 20, like thinking, what am I going to be doing 20 years from now? I mean, hopefully living and thriving in San Diego. But, you know, so for people that are in, have immediate family that have more immediate needs, the legal immigration system is essentially non-existent.
Are there people working within to actually change the laws and change the systems and make it easier for people to not have to jump through so many hoops?
There are. That's part of the role of nonprofit organizations like Al Otro Lado. We file all types of petitions, both affirmative and represent people in defensive postures. They're already in removal deportation proceedings, and then we're fighting deportation. But we also have litigation. So we have at AOL, we have a Freedom of Information Act team where we're filing lawsuits trying to shed light on particular policies, potentially with the goal of challenging them. Other organizations around the country are doing that work, trying to challenge laws that are unconstitutional or violate the due process or other laws in some way. The current immigration policy is not the result or not just the result of Donald Trump and Stephen Miller and this administration, although this administration has demonstrated an extreme level of hostility towards immigrants and willingness and, in fact, enthusiasm to dehumanize immigrant communities that I think is really beyond the pale and unprecedented, right? But the immigration system is decades in the making, right? I mean, there have been numerous laws over the years that both Democrats and Republicans have enthusiastically signed on to increase the criminalization of immigration acts, to increase the basis by which a person can be deported for all kinds of different things, to make it harder to get immigration status in the United States. And I think this is really part of America's long-term story. We've had kind of ups and downs or changes to the immigration laws over decades, and at different points in time have tended toward increased xenophobia, where we're, you know, there back in the 20s, there was the quota system where basically, you know, we were favoring immigrants from Western white European countries and disfavoring immigrants from other areas. And right now it feels like we're at a moment where at least our leaders are demonstrating, and I would say, a xenophobia and dehumanization of non-citizens that's really starting to, I think, affect all of us in society, because one thing we yet haven't quite gotten to, but it's just the increased funding for immigration enforcement and ICE in our communities and all of that. There are all kinds of organizations and lawyers that are challenging the immigration laws. That's a slow process. And yet there have been some advances, right? For example, there's the National Qualified Representative Program that was stood up maybe a little over 10 years ago, where as a result of litigation, immigration courts provide attorneys for people that are incompetent to represent themselves. They've agreed that, yes, we'll go ahead and give you a lawyer if you're incompetent. There's the legal orientation program that's continued to receive, that was receiving bipartisan support over the decades. The Trump administration ended that program, but it was sort of, I think, some efforts to grant support or acknowledge rights of non-citizens in immigration proceedings. Same goes for children. You know, there's the Flores settlement that has then, you know, resulted in recognition that children have rights, that unaccompanied children have rights. I'm not saying that the tale of immigration in the United States has just continuously been one where, you know, it's trending negatively. But the Trump administration certainly has tried to roll back a number of different advances. They've ended many of those programs that I've just mentioned, or tried to whittle away at them, or, you know, death by a thousand cuts, make them essentially ineffective. So I guess that's my long-winded answer that, yes, there are organizations that are trying to change the laws. It's slow. And also, you know, it's not just the Trump administration. It's really been decades where in the United States we've increasingly criminalized immigration acts and also made it harder to apply for immigration relief.
And like everything that you're saying, Cassandra, it obviously reflects on the other side of the border as well, with people who cross the border every day to go to work, to go to school. Some border commuters, pedestrians mentioned that crossing the border has become more strict, that enforcement by Mexican immigration at the Mexican port of entry has become more strict. What can you say about this?
Yeah, I think we've seen that as well at AOL. We at Al Otro Lado, we have an office in Tijuana as well as in Mexico City, where we're sort of both tracking and supporting immigration issues from the Mexican side. And we have this border that's become increasingly militarized and increasingly fortified, and inspections now on both sides. It's not surprising to me that Mexico has started to increase inspections with the way that the Trump administration has been speaking about Mexico and making hostile statements to Mexico, our neighbor to the south. We really should be working with the Mexican government to, it seems like, that would be in our best interest, even, you know, through the stated lens of, say, like the Trump administration claims to be concerned about fentanyl and, you know, about drug trafficking. Well, you know, if we're going to be trying to stop that at the border, we would want to be working with the Mexican authorities instead of alienating them. So I have noticed just anecdotally going southbound into Tijuana that there's more inspection and more traffic. And I think that we are only going to see that increase, especially since the Trump administration's funding and focus is on enforcement. It's not about like making the border a streamlined place to cross so that it's easy for people to live in TJ and work in the San Diego area or in the United States, even though we could have that approach. But unfortunately, that's not the case.
There's also a memo posted on the CBP website saying that the agency is now authorized to collect biometric data at ports of entry. How could it affect people who regularly cross the border, like me and Alan and our producer Julio?
Well, I don't know why. you'd have to ask them. But it impacts all of us, right? Every time that I've been covering Border Patrol, they roll out these kind of mass data collecting and mass surveillance programs, and they don't always work out the way they want them to. I mean, going back to CBP1, right, that had big issues with the facial recognition mm-hmm. figure, right? You had to take a picture of yourself in order to get an appointment. And early on, the first version of it, Haitian people struggled to get the app to recognize their face because it didn't work well with people with darker skin tones than lighter skin tones. So that's just like a practical problem with it. But on a bigger issue, Border Patrol doesn't have a great history with mass surveillance. We've seen it in the U.S. now. And I think that's what I like to tell folks who aren't from the border region, that oftentimes these technologies will begin at the border and then they will be used in the interior of the country. We've seen it a little bit with facial recognition, but automated license plate readers are one that I've covered. And we are seeing Border Patrol use automated license plate readers to conduct immigration searches, sometimes in violation of sanctuary laws here in California. So I think the general public should be just a little concerned about how this is being rolled out. And we don't always know how this information is going to be used in the future. I know even in the past, I think this was during the first Trump administration, where some Al Otro Lado attorneys were caught in this when the migrant caravans came around 2019, 2018. Mm-hmm. Border Patrol was using their technology to spy on journalists, lawyers, humanitarians who were helping the migrant caravan.
Maybe as we start, did you want to say something?
I was just going to add that I think it generally raises concerns, the biometrics at the border and increased surveillance, about normalizing constant surveillance and constitutional issues relating to privacy and freedom from unreasonable government monitoring. Like Gustavo mentioned, I think there's concerns about tracking and spying on journalists, but really anyone, activists or anyone who doesn't fully support Trump's agenda. It could also potentially be used to target and interrogate or refer for inspection, secondary inspection, people based on national origin, religious beliefs, political views. And I think there's a concern that biometrics is unreliable, or concerns just about how reliable it is. So like Gustavo mentioned with Haitians and getting them to track facial recognition, if they're going to be using facial recognition to refer people to secondary inspection, but it's unreliable, I think that could then result in, you know, people being erroneously sent for secondary inspection or interrogation. So I think it raises a host of concerns. And we want the government to clearly articulate why they're doing this, how they're maintaining security, what happens if there's a data breach, what they're going to do with the data, how long it's going to be stored, things like those concerns. I think we want answers from the government about those questions. And I think it, you know, generally we should all be concerned that the government is, you know, surveilling us. It sounds something like we hear about in China, and I don't think Americans are ready for the government to be monitoring their every move.
Yeah, maybe to help us digest all this, we can leave off as we wrap this up with a little bit of guidance from you guys, some practical advice on what we can do moving forward, or our listeners can do. For example, like what should mixed status families be thinking about right now?
I mean, I can only pass along advice I've heard from other immigration lawyers, and it sounds grim, but come up with a plan. Right, almost like an emergency plan. If you're mixed status, have a plan for what you're going to do if and when the undocumented member of your family gets detained. Who are the kids going to call? Is there a neighbor or family member who could be there? Is there money set aside to cover rent or car payments, things like that? Find a good immigration lawyer. AILA is a good resource. They have a searchable database where you can. AILA is the American Immigration Lawyer Association, and they have a search tool that you can find folks in your area. They're specialized in certain aspects within immigration law. I would point them to resources like that. But as grim as it sounds, come up with a plan, because being prepared and educated about some of these issues will hopefully eliminate a little bit of that anxiety and stress and fear that people are feeling.
And to that end, I would call people's attention to this app that it was created by Human Rights First. Basically, this is an app that people can download to their phones. It's a secure one-click emergency alert system for immigrant families. So you input information ahead of time, and there are a number of different templates that help you come up with, you know, instructions for childcare, for legal defense, for financial concerns. And then if you're detained by ICE, you can press click and it sends out your emergency plan to your pre-designated contacts, and then it wipes the emergency plan from your phone in case your phone is seized and searched. So I think that is at least a way for people in mixed status families to come up with some planning around what happens if a person is detained, to handle things like, you know, minor children or financial concerns. And then also, I will remind people to, if you are detained either by the police or by immigration, everything you say can and will be used against you. And non-citizens, unfortunately, if you're arrested for immigration violations, could also be subject to criminal charges. The government, for example, is requiring people to register, and it's failure to register with immigration is a misdemeanor. And it applies to everyone over the age of 14. So it's potentially, you know, the government could start prosecuting people for misdemeanors who are detained, even though they have no criminal record and are not doing anything illegal. They're simply being in public in the United States. So anything you say can be used against you. So it's really important never to speak to the police or to immigration authorities without a lawyer. You don't have to be rude about it. All you have to say is, I don't want to talk to you without my lawyer present. I would also be wary about where you go. We've had cases at Al Otro Lado where people that were not citizens, but that had either were here legally with parole or were had some kind of status, have gone on to military bases and then been detained. Mm. We were contacted by an individual who was driving for work, delivering something to a military base, went onto the base, and ICE was called, and that person ended up in immigration detention. So if I was concerned about my immigration status, I would not be going on to military bases. I say that because here in San Diego, there's a number of military bases in the area. I would also be aware and just remind people that ICE is allowed to racially profile. The Supreme Court granted permission to ICE last year to use a person's ethnic identity and appearance as the basis to stop them and question them. So unfortunately, if you look quote unquote Latino or if you look quote unquote ethnic, you can be stopped by ICE and they can question you. And to be clear, I am not giving legal advice, but I would urge anyone to consult with an immigration lawyer before they speak with the police or with immigration authorities.
Thank you so much, Cassandra and Gustavo. Obviously, this is a conversation that can keep going for a long time, and hopefully we'll have it again. We really appreciate your time and you guys sharing your expertise and just for all the work you do to help people stay informed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Friends, as you heard in today's episode, it's been a complicated year for people living in the border region.
And an especially difficult one for mixed-status families.
If the past year has taught us anything, it's that the next 3 years are likely to be just as challenging.
We hope our conversation with Gustavo and Cassandra has been both insightful and informative. This episode would also be available in Spanish.
This episode of Port of Entry was written and produced by Julio Cesar Ortiz Franco.
Adrián Villalobos is technical producer and sound designer.
This episode was edited by Chrissy Wynn.
Lisa Jane Morissette is director of audio programming and operations.
Stay safe, everybody, and nos vemos pronto.
Satisfy your celluloid addiction with the Cinema Junkie podcast, where you can mainline film with the people who make them, as well as those who love them, program them, and celebrate them for their cultural impact. Listen to Cinema Junkie wherever you get your podcasts.